I recognised in Michael also this bohemian thing immediately. He had an ability to be able to walk out of a room and not want to walk back into it again. Michael was always walking from one door to the other, like a gypsy. One probably difference with Michael from the rest of us, he did live an international existence before he was even in a rock band. To his credit, it gave us a lot of confidence and strength to feel like we knew what we were doing.
Hi, I'm Kirk Pengilly.
I'm Andrew Farris.
And we're from NXS.
And we're in the studio for Shine Like It Does, the NXS Anthology, Part 1.
Rock and roll was showing its age in 1982. Led Zeppelin was over. The Rolling Stones, The Who, Eric Clapton, and Pink Floyd self-consciously were making forgettable albums after the punks had rattled their dinosaur cages. Then the punks' promise was never kept, and they too self-destructed. Yes, and Emerson, Lake & Palmer were anachronisms by 1982. And the American bands fared even worse. The Grateful Dead and the Allman Brothers Band seemed boring, with long guitar solos. Okay, any guitar solos, seeming so cliched. Lynyrd Skynyrd had fallen from the sky 5 years earlier. Aerosmith in 1982 appeared to be on a very permanent vacation. The Cinderella Band, Boston, had more court dates than they ever had concerts. And REO Speedwagon, Styx, and Journey, emphasizing the pop and popular, would never gain critical acclaim, nor equal their respective sales again. But where else but London, New York, or Los Angeles could we expect to find music that was tight and right for the time? The answer had come in 1979 and 1980 from a most unlikely place, in the form of the seemingly most unlikely band, Australia and AC/DC. Could there be any more bands with that potential down under? America quickly would know two more Australian exports, the phenomenal Men at Work and the steadily improving band NXS. The latter band was built around three talented brothers, guitarist Tim Farris, middle brother, pianist, songwriter Andrew Farris, and drummer John. Andrew Farris explains the humble beginnings of NXS.
The Farrises, we grew up as kids in a city called Perth, which is in the west coast of Australia. I was born, 1959. Tim was born 1957. John was born 1961. Our dad worked in insurance. And the only thing I would say was a little unusual about our childhood, in as much as Perth itself as a city, I think even to this day, is still the most remote geographical city in the world. In other words, it's to the west of Perth. It's got the Indian Ocean all the way around it. And then to north, you've got like 2,000 miles till you reach the next Australian city. Then south, you've got the Antarctic. And east, you've got Adelaide, which is again 2,000 miles away. So as kids growing up, we had a coastline literally probably the size of the east coast of America as a playground, if you like.
They used to go for really long walks.
That sense of space, the Aboriginals call it walkabout, but the sense of space and that feeling of openness around us as kids, it's something I really truly remember with a lot of fondness, because in the world is getting smaller and smaller with technology. There's more and more people. There's more and more stuff going on all the time. There's less and less privacy. And in those early years, it was a very secure environment too, because no one locked their houses as much, or there's no point in, even locking your car up, really. I mean, if someone stole a car, where are they going to drive it to? because there's nowhere to go.
The sky.
That's one of the earliest songs by NXS that most Americans heard in early 1983, called Don't Change. But realize that the album from which it came, Shabu Shuba, was already the third NXS album, with the songwriting credited to the three Ferris brothers, plus bass player Gary Beers, singer Michael Hutchins, and sax player guitarist Kirk Pengilly. Andrew Ferris, joined by Kirk, continues the early saga of NXS and the fateful meeting with co-writer and singer Michael Hutchins.
The other thing was, then my dad moved east to Sydney. He got a promotion, and I, you know, started going to school, and that's where I met Michael. I think first 3 weeks of high school, actually, he got off a bus from Hong Kong, and he was looking really insecure, and I think he was probably real nervous too, because Australia as a culture, you know, it can be, you know, when I say it's a frontier, I mean, I think that's disappearing now, but back then, yeah, I mean, you know, even 20, would you say, Kirk, 20, 30 years ago, Australia,
pretty rugged place.
Pretty rugged place, a frontier type place. I mean, not as crazy as like Lee Marvin on a wagon with a bottle of whiskey, but I mean, it wasn't, you know, if you know what I mean. When we arrived in Sydney as well, I think Kirk and Tim became good friends too, you know, and through school, was it, Kirk?
Yeah.
Actually, I found an ad in a paper because we're looking for a bass player for our band that we had, and I called up, and I think, you know, it was funny because I said to Gary, you play bass? Oh, that's great. And I got a car. Oh, great. Well, come on around, you know, come around, because he had a car, you know, and no one else had a car, you know, because we were kids. And I think that's where we all sort of met. But then Michael, you know, I to be honest with you, I didn't really see much of him after I met him originally in school. We didn't see each other that much. And then he went overseas with his family to Hollywood. He went to school in Hollywood High School. Yeah, he did. And
just for a couple of years, yeah.
Yeah. And then when he came back to Sydney, you know, we suddenly found we had, you know, completely – we had a lot in common, you know. We were into similar music and girls and, you know, pot smoking and stuff, and just the normal teen things of that era, you know, the 70s. And we found a lot in common artistically. He was really into poetry too. He was always, you know, a voracious reader and really into literature and the arts. But he could never play an instrument. And so, I did, and I play, you know, two or three different instruments. And I think I recognized in Michael also this bohemian thing immediately. He had an ability to be able to walk out of a room and not want to walk back into it again. Michael was always walking from one door to the other, like a gypsy.
To explain the international nature of the business of Michael Hutchins' father, here's NXS sax player Kirk Pengilly, followed by Andrew Ferris of NXS.
He used to import a lot of stuff, I think, into Australia, clothing and different things. And so he's pretty wild, Michael's dad. He used to do kind of runs to New Guinea and stuff, I think. I don't know, in the war and whatever else. I think, yeah, through that. And Michael's mother actually was a makeup artist. I think that might have been part of the reason they moved to Hollywood for a while there, because she was doing makeup in movies and things like that. It probably helped, one, to create, you know, a strength in Michael, in a way, a confidence, but also I think musically, you know, a broad sort of appreciation of different types and different styles. I mean, his parents used to apparently have cocktail parties all the time. They were sort of, you know, of the cocktail set, if you know what I mean, in the 60s. So I think there was probably a lot of, you know, Sergio Mendes and Brazil 66 and that sort of stuff, you know. Girl from Ipanema.
Michael also had probably difference with Michael from the rest of us. He did live an international existence before he was even in a rock band as a person. He was used to dealing with, especially coming from Hong Kong, it's a complex, you know, China is a very complex place, a lot of diverse, you know, dialects, and you got Mandarin, Cantonese, you know, and a mind-boggling array of food items, and you know, they'll eat anything, they'll eat your dog, you know. I mean, when we went overseas, I think it was a lot of the reason, I think, why people were immediately intrigued with him too, because he probably didn't look like he was just like trying to get it together. He kind of already had it together when we hit the stages overseas in an international sense. He wasn't like, oh, okay, I'm just coping here and I'm pretending I'm putting on a brave face. He really knew exactly what he was doing. To his credit, it gave us a lot of confidence and strength to feel like we knew what we were doing.
With their first U.S. success, early 1983's The One Thing, from their third album, Shabu Shaba. Kirk Pengilly recalls the launching pad for international success.
Well, I guess both Sydney and Melbourne had literally, you know, every pub had bands, you know, on sort of most of them 7 nights a week. And as you can imagine, you know, you've probably heard about the beer consumption of Australia. There's a lot of pubs, you know. We worked sort of pretty hard around that era to build up a bit of a following in sort of one particular area of Sydney, what's called the North Shore. And we had a couple of resident gigs every week. We were playing, you know, maybe 9 shows a week. And you could play for like a month, 6 weeks, and not play the same place, you know, in Sydney. And then we go down to Melbourne and do the same down there, you know, spend 3 weeks down there, really healthy sort of thing. And then rather than, you know, taking a demo to the record company, it kind of worked from the word-of-mouth live thing. As soon as you kind of had a vibe going on, they'd hear about it and then they'd come and see you. And if, you know, you'd get signed or you wouldn't. But, that, you know, they were pretty rough and tough, very, you know, unforgiving audiences. You know, lots of beer and sweat. And I mean, some of the venues would get so hot because a lot of the publicans would leave the air conditioning off so people would drink more. and they cram, you know, twice as many people in as you're, you know, legally allowed to. And the roof would just build up with condensation, you know, so much so that it would start dripping on you from all the heat and the sweat. And the,
it was nuts.
It was pretty nuts. And then I predominantly pretty sort of rock orientated.
That's where AC/DC came from, the same environment.
Yeah. Mm. It was very, you know, very rock and very sort of tough. I mean, if you, you know, if you're crap, then, you know, you'd get beer bottles and cans and things thrown at you. You know, it's a bit like those that Blues Brothers scene with the cage in front of the stage, you know. but it was a lot of fun and you know, it was just intense, really. I think it was just a great sort of playground to sort of learn, you know, learn your trade.
Andrew Farris of NXS continues.
In that environment that Kirk was explaining, you know, with the constant condensation and sweat pouring, you know, because, you know, it like as if, like, you've got to come down and see these guys in their element to get the picture here, you know. So, you know, Reen, to her credit, did exactly that and came down to Sydney and saw us play it at the Sylvania Hotel. I think she just left that night with her mouth open going, what was that? You know, like, what, you know, a kind of, who are these people and what is this, you know? So, and I mean, we to a certain extent were kind of a little bit unaware of the significance of it all a bit because, you know, we were in context with ourselves in our time. We were young. We were just doing our thing. Mm. So we didn't really think about it too much. And then, also, the thing a lot of people seem may not realize is that we were playing in licensed liquor houses, you know, pubs, where everybody had to be over 18. So we were, you know, in just 18 ourselves, playing to people who are, you know, anywhere from 18 years old, supposed to be 18 years old, up to, you know, 45, 50 years of age, you know, every night. And then when we came to the US after we got signed, we had this screaming thing from little girls, you know, which to us was like
teddy bears.
Why are all these people screaming and throwing little teddy bears and stuff when we've just been performing to adults, you know? And so it was very weird, you know, and we immediately got this teeny thing going on, which to us we found, quite frankly, really kind of nauseating and not at all what we really were sort of looking for, hoping for, you know. When you come from that background, that's where you cut your teeth. Your music does have a kind of a bit of a nasty edge to it. And when they began to realize, when, you know, the young, real young fans stateside came to see us, they began to realize that, hang on, these guys might look kind of cute, but their music's like a razor blade here, you know. And I think then we got a completely different kind of audience started to come see us, and, you know, perhaps, you know, taken on a lot more seriously just through live performance, I think, more than anything. We immediately were taken on board by promoters. We found ourselves even in the first tour, I think, wasn't it, Kirk? We ended up doing the US Festival in front of 350,000 people in California. And I remember thinking, my God, what is this? You know, like, you know, that's half the population of the city I was born in. You know what I mean,
yeah, exactly.
What is this? You know, but I'm sure it wasn't lost on promoters at the time and the record company standing side stage staring at us, going, "These guys are handling this. You know, this is not worrying them."
Hi, this is Andrew Farris from NXS.
Hi, this is Michael Hutchins of NXS.
I want you to take me back for a second to that fateful trip. I guess it was about April 1982. It was a decision to travel to London, and I'll bet probably New York City. I know you came to America to try to secure for NXS an international record deal. First mm-hmm. of all, why was that necessary? You were making hit records in Australia. Mm-hmm. Why was that? What did you discuss? Why was that trip necessary?
It wasn't necessary. I think we're pretty open. I mean, we just decided to go for a bit of a jaunt, really. We thought that'd be fun. And we could sit around in London and in New York and LA or wherever. And, you know, we just started writing an album. So Kirk, Andrew and I started to get together. And we actually ended up in London in a house, a sort of ex-brothel by the memory serves me well. It was very purple and mirrored. And we sat around and
And the phones ring.
And the phones ring. And we sat around and wrote stuff. I mean, whether or not anything came out of it internationally, we weren't really that bothered. We were actually very we were excited and consumed by the fact that we could be somewhere new and write music. And the influences were great. And we were seeing reggae for the first time, properly. Mm. We were seeing, you know, New York bands. We were seeing all kinds of stuff. Yeah, I don't know. We'd seen bands in Australia. As you said, we had success in Australia. We'd seen bands in Australia bore themselves to death with it, you know. It's all very well, you know, you can have your success, but, you know, it's so many times you can do your tricks and play down the road and people just start, you know, take the gun pointing at your feet, dance, boy, dance, you know, what are you going to do after a while? So we decided to actually get out of there quickly as possible in a way, once we'd really played it and, you know, made some friends and go overseas and play a bit and then come back again. So keep it fresh for the audience, you know.
Yeah, I mean, we'd actually built up quite a career overseas outside of Australia before Australians really realized we had, which was sort of strange, you know.
I didn't realize that either.
No, well, it was, it was good, really, I think about it.
What was that? Building up?
Well,
building up a career outside of Australia, or in Australia?
No, outside.
Yeah, yeah. You
know, and Australians not being aware of the fact that we've been doing that.
Yeah,
You know, it was funny to go back and people say, "Well, what have you been doing?" You know, "Oh, what have I been doing?" You know, I just spent 3 months, you know, sitting on a tour bus. You know,
I think it was a good move for us. Kept us fresh. When we come back, you know, you go away, you get a lot of influences, or at least you live a lot, and you come back, and people aren't sick of you, and you play around the corner again, you know. Mm. We didn't get to an end in Australia and had to go overseas, which is basically what a lot of bands did in Australia, and then it's kind of too late.
You got it. Michael Hutchence and Tim Ferriss, third record, Listen Like Thieves. And it sounds like you are about to really make your mark, not only on America, but the world. Is this tour is like a nine-month thing, Tim?
Yeah, we've been all over the world, actually, on this tour.
How long have you been out? How long has it been since you've been home?
Jesus, man.
They can't remember.
6 months, 7 months since we've been home.
Are you serious? You've been playing for that long?
Well, actually, we flew home real quick just to do a quick concert for Charles and Di. We're only home for like a couple of days.
Now, are you putting me on or didn't?
No.
Huh?
Yeah. It was great. It was called Rockin' the Royals. We made a special.
Rockin' the Royals.
Yeah. We really rocked. They rocked.
They shake those things.
But you know, we've seen some video here in America of especially Di. I guess she's really a pop music fan.
Yeah,
I guess she is. Yeah. She's real pretty in the flesh too. I'm telling you,
that's what everybody talks about her. Nobody talks about
poor
Charlie.
Charles, you know,
poor Charlie. Yeah. It's like, Charles, go play polo, and we'll see you later.
Exactly.
Right?
Leave
behind.
The third album, Listen Like Thieves. Does the title have any kind? Is that a slogan or some kind of phrase in Australia?
Not really. I just sort of made it up. It was. I guess it was about. Everybody listening, you know, carefully. Everybody's out listening, and everybody's a thief one way or another. Ah. Everybody's trying to get some way through life, or listening to the TV or reading papers.
Actually, we're hoping it just makes people think about the album and listen to it like a thief would.
Yeah, you know? Like a thief would in the night. I've got one more question before we get into some of the music. I'm intrigued by the little sticker here on the cover. I want to show it to you. It says special. Limited edition album cover. Now, wait a minute. We've had limited edition mixes, special colored vinyl and stuff. There are only a handful of limited edition album covers. What is limited about it? If you rush right out and buy the new NXS album now,
I guess because it's a gatefold and it's got a big sort of photo inside.
So you're saying the fold out?
Naked.
Yeah. From
What was that now, Tim?
I'm money pulling. We're not really naked. It's not limited.
So what you're saying is that all the additional artwork and all the pictures and everything like that won't be there forever.
No. Okay. It'll become a single sort of cover.
After the first 10 million copies.
Yeah. First 10 million.
I will believe you if you say it's true. Girl, you know I need you more than any words spoken. I've seen you before, turn and walk away. You say you won't come back, it's just a game in a way. We are hoping, yes, and we're praying. This time will be the last time.
That is This Time. It's from INXS, their third album, Listen Like Thieves. Michael Hutchins, Tim Ferriss with us from INXS in the Out of Control Room. wasn't that written by brother Andrew?
Andrew, it certainly was. He wrote that on an acoustic guitar. It's got
that feel. I can hear it coming down that way, sure. It also sounds slightly different, I think, than just about anything else on the record. Does anybody ever mention that? Is.
It's a bit more anthematic, I suppose,
in
many ways.
That?
It was probably written and recorded pretty fast. Actually, the whole album really was written pretty quickly.
Tell me about that. I understand that you went in with just loose ideas and let the chemistry kind of happen, Michael.
We went back to our old rehearsal studio, the old Cockroach Pit. And
Eye of the Tiger, yeah.
Yeah, gotcha.
We just sort of spent 2 weeks in there and having a blast, and hopefully all the songs are sort of songs that you can play on an acoustic guitar anyway by yourself. That was the idea, get into the studio and do it live, and the songs should stand up on their own.
You're right.
Yeah, we wanted to do songs for song's sake.
You're right.
On this album,
Yeah. We're with Michael Hutchins and Tim Ferriss of INXS in concert tonight. That's why I said that it's interesting. This Time has as you said, has a real acoustic, put your foot up on the stump here and just strum out this tune, whereas so many other the songs, at least the ones I really go for on the new album, they're very, very danceable, rock and roll.
It's the way we do things. I suppose, we really like funk and a lot of black American music, and we kind of use that as the foundation on the rhythm section and put all the rock
classic
and roll
rock
and
guitar
stuff
the
on
top.
Top.
Yeah, yeah. I mentioned to you that, boy, it sounded like Memphis horn charts circa about 1968
right.
there. I could hear Otis Redding with those horns. Great,
yep,
great
little
feel.
Kirk blowing his guts out there.
Eyes bulging.
Yeah, and that bass is just really rolling. Very good. Let's take a listen to the title track, Listen Like Thieves, INXS.
Hesitate.
That was Listen Like These, the title tune that ends ice cold with NXS in the control room with us here. We have Michael and Tim. In the interviews and things like that I've read about you, you've really pushed the point, though, that it is so much a band, that there really are band decisions and band compositions and things like that, and that it's a very democratic thing.
Yeah.
You've been together for so long. Do you not even feel that, Michael, as far as that brother connection?
Tim and I are probably more like brothers than he is with his other brothers, I tell you.
Isn't that remarkable? Yeah. Don't you find that to be fascinating?
It's great.
It's kind of like we grew up together, everyone.
Yeah,
so.
In the band.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and the three brothers are very much individuals. They're very different people from each other. And, it's like we're all brothers now. We've been together for 10 years
as friends,
and it's like 6-7 years as a band. So,
isn't it? But it's really remarkable that hurdle you jumped years ago, right?
Yeah, that's right.
You know,
because
it would be a normal tendency.
Really,
right?
In the first year, we got over that hurdle because we lived together.
Our garage was like where we all used to meet and get together and stuff, because we had the biggest
bands,
garage.
That's where they are, where you had the biggest garage. Like, yeah, that's where you had.
So it always happened in our garage, you know?
Or my living room.
Oh, or now it's your living room, right? I'm Redbeard with Michael Hutchins and Tim Ferriss of NXS. I am fascinated by the, just the sheer physical distance between our two countries and life and everything like that. And yet, music is such an international thing. It just, it's the automatic international universal language, isn't it?
It's a ripper, mate. It's fantastic. No, it is.
It really is. How, let me rephrase it. Can you tell, Tim, when the lights go down and you walk out, you plug in, you set up, you get the nod, you hit it, the lights come on, and because you're staring into a black concert hall, you can only see maybe the first three or four rows. Can you tell, could you tell you were playing to an Australian audience rather than American or an English audience? Or is it pretty much...
That is difficult to answer.
Think about it.
I mean, it's pretty similar in a way. To Australia, actually, American audience, especially here in Texas.
And why do you think that is?
I don't know. I guess
what similarities
topographically,
you feel?
It's pretty similar. You know,
there's
a lot of desert near Australia, and I guess you're fairly close to the beach here. And
you can be. That's true. We've got somebody said if we had snow in the mountains,
you'd have everything. Right?
We'd have everything in this state. And I think that's a good way to put it.
Yeah, it is. Well, there's a large surfy kind of. Audience in Australia too that we play to. I mean, everyone sort of surfs because everyone grows up on the coast, you know.
Yeah.
But the only place you definitely know you weren't in Australia are the real obvious places like Japan, you know.
Or
Argentina even.
Okay, and you've played all these places.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Fascinating. It really is.
It's about a month and a half ago we did our first show in Buenos Aires. 25,000 seater sold out, which was really
25
awesome.
Soccer stadium, barbed wire, soccer stadium.
It was unbelievable.
Tell me about that.
Well, what happened was they get kind of excited there.
Mm.
I mean, they'd like to have a good time. And what happened is they put up a barricade down the front. When we actually arrived for sound check, Nina Hagen had played the night before. They had a metal barricade, and that was torn into like tin can shreds.
You're kidding.
And so they put up a wooden one about 15 foot high. Mm. So nobody in the front could see us, right? So they just started to kick holes through it and climb over, and the security guys are using riot sticks on these people. So I'm using my microphone stand on the security guys. Security guys are trying to hit me. In the meantime, it was keep like these people off stage.
And perform at the same time?
Well, that was about the end of the night, luckily.
It was really wild. I mean, these guys are using
film too.
6-foot poles on the audience. You know?
It's unbelievable. So I'm freaking out, you know, saying, what the hell are you doing?
Yeah.
Hitting these guys on my mic stand and... trying to hit me. I mean, we got it down on film. I have to have a look at it sometime.
But it
turned out good. I mean,
it's very strange.
They said it was pretty normal.
The some good friends of ours in the band Crocus played down there in the Rock in Rio
last winter.
And they said they came out and there's, like 80,000 people, and they looked outside of the stadium and just to the, to the far wall outside the stadium, there is like a hill. And they said you could see armed military men with automatic rifles ringing That's the venue. That's the kind of atmosphere. That's weird.
When we left the concert, like the whole like our limousine outside the stadium was just like surrounded entirely by machine gun armed guards, like in a big square.
And do they really think they're doing you a favor? I mean, is that necessary?
The people kept away. That's for sure.
They didn't come too close. Didn't sign too many autographs.
This is Michael Hutchence of NXS.
What songwriters have, in hindsight, really influenced your songwriting, influenced your pop sensibilities the most?
Well, funnily enough, that's a really interesting question. I don't think I've been asked that. I think I probably relate more on a songwriting thing to people like, say, for example, like The Doors, say, for, I want to say, like a Ray Manzarek thing, where he could somehow manage to be on your television station, yet sort of manage to make people go, what is this? I don't know that I like this, you know. We shouldn't be listening to this or something, perhaps, you know, from a song. I like to I like music to move me, and I like when I'm doing something to move other people. I don't want to just make music to fit in with some format or something. It has to move people, you know. So that for example, that's just one act. I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of other people over the space of years that, I mean, there's, you know, classical composers, for example, in centuries past, some of the chord changes those people played with.
Anybody in particular that you're thinking?
Yeah, Beethoven. Okay. And, yeah, now you're testing the limits of my classical knowledge, I suppose.
That's one more than me.
Yeah, but, you know, Stravinsky and even weird guys like Schoenberg and you know, there's been strange musical things going down the past with Stockhausen, and then you've got people playing these days with electronic gear, and then they put things together and they write with electronic gear, and even if they probably don't even realize they're doing it, they're actually doing something with a different medium again. But it's all just music. It's the same notation unless you step into some weird quarter note scales. It's all the same thing, you know?
I'm most curious, though, about what songwriters would have really affected your pop sensibility. Something let's say something as basic as it really made you want to write a song someday half as good as.
Okay.
Not necessarily
I like a lot of the 60s writing, not because I was just, you know, obviously very impressionable at that age, but more so because I like the spirit of it, you know. It's really interesting stuff. Mind you, as I get a little older, there's also some interesting stuff happening in the 70s as well. And I mean even some of the most daggy stuff you could imagine. And also through to punk and what that did as songwriting as well. It's just streamlined. Everything got suddenly, everything was very flowery in the mid-70s. You had these overdone, some classical pieces with people crapping on. And then,
yeah, people don't realize that the Sex Pistols are actually have so much in common with the early Beatles singles. Really,
basic chord changes.
Because before the Beatles came along, it was all sort of Perry Como and schmaltz, you know. And they came along and spent three chords, verse, chorus, bridge, verse, chorus, bye. And that's exactly what a Pistols song is, you know? And it was just upgraded with a little bit more attitude.
They copped it to the point of no solos.
No solos.
No banal guitar solo in the middle. It's like,
exactly.
They didn't do that in the Beatles didn't do that in the early days. And so
that's right.
The Pistols, like,
no indulgence.
Forget the guitar solo.
Actually,
that's why people loved punk, you know?
Just like, along those lines, one group of people, I think, who were immensely clever, I mean, you know, brilliant, was a Motown group of people, because they were, like, to me, almost on a leg on their own. They were fantastic singers, fantastic players. They were doing something that had never been done before.
What kind of shift do you think, what kind of things do you think are unique, maybe challenges, considerations that a band has to make wanting to hit the international scene if you're coming from Australia, as opposed to New York City or London?
I don't know. We actually didn't, to be honest, we didn't take anything into consideration. We really didn't. You know, we thought, look, what are you going to do? People don't want to see another version of what they have around the road, down the road. And we were very lucky. I mean, I suppose if we came over and nothing happened, we might have, you know, sold out and sort of said, well, we better, you know, get ringlets and spandex pants or something. But we didn't, you know. I don't know.
Let me give you.
We couldn't afford them.
I'll give you an example how basic I'm talking about, though. The first time I met Michael and we did an interview in Dallas, he was talking about the flight, just the magnitude of the flight from Australia to L.A. And then come to see us, let's say, in Dallas.
Yeah.
And the numbers are like what? 22 hours or something outrageous on a plane. And I said, I've never heard. I can't imagine. I've never heard. And he said, we're used to it. This is a step that if you're from Australia and you're going to do business.
I see what you mean, yeah.
This is something that we all accept. It's we don't go on and dread it as it's relative.
Yeah. Anywhere you go, it's going to be
an
that.
It's an enormous gamble, you know. And sometimes people in Australia go, oh, what about that band? Why haven't they done well overseas, you know? And they, you know, but it's such a big gamble and such an enormous undertaking. You know, it costs you a lot of money before you even catch a cab to the hotel, you know.
That's right.
Just to get there, get the guys there and get the gear there, you know. You're sitting around the hotel, you've already spent 100 grand, you know. You're sitting around going, okay, well, and that's loans, you know. We went to the bank, went, right.
Yeah, we were,
you know,
pretty,
we're mad.
Yeah, we were completely crazy. If you really want the truth, we were like putting your spaghetti into the strainer, you know, to cool water on it. We got stuck in the strainer. We're the mad spaghetti. I mean, really, you can say a lot of things. You could say that all this coming from Australia sorts the men out from the boys, the crazy ones from the sane ones. I don't know. I mean, I don't know what it is, but all I know is that we just kept doing it. And perhaps it was a lot of faith. Well, I was about to say perhaps a lot of it was just a blind faith that maybe we would do what we wanted to do and whatever may. You know?
It's an adventure regardless. I suppose in a lot of ways we've always had, you know, a sense of humor and a wanderlust in a way. And we've always thought, well, you know, let's just go out there and try it. You can get stars in your eyes, but I don't think we really had that many stars in our eyes. I think we just had a good, healthy sort of dose of adventure as well, you know, and things have gone well for us.
Yeah.
We've always tried to maintain that, I mean, naively so, that we're a garage band done well almost, or a pub act done well, which is
literally
great, you know, which we are, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we've tried to maintain that.
Yeah.
But it's worked for us. You know, kept our feet on the ground.
Exactly. I mean, also, you want to talk about long plane flights for poor little old us. I mean, you know, you've got a lot of sporting people who do this as well. You know, you've got your U.S. tennis stars and you've got your, when I say stars, I should say players, because these people are supreme in what they do, okay? I'm going to give that respect. And also, I like watching tennis. But and same with, you know, all sorts of sports people as well that tour on an international circuit.
It's a similar gig, isn't it?
You know, and these people put up with tremendous stresses, let alone having to go out there under cameras and perform their bit, you know, for whatever. And you see John McEnroe throwing a tennis racket around or whatever, and sometimes I think, who'd blame him? I mean, you get there at the end of the day, you think, what am I playing tennis or am I playing something else? So I was saying the lifestyle itself is when you travel is you've got to make a decision to do that, and that's part of the job.
I guess you've got nothing else to compare it to, but I don't know. For my money, I just think that little things that you take for granted, because all of your mates have had to do the same thing, if they were going to make it this far, this big in the international music scene, they've all had to do it, and you feel that you're in some way, I guess, not special. But I guess comparing it to what so many bands that, you mentioned Deep Purple a few minutes ago. Roger Glover is a good friend of mine, and he said there's really only three cities in America, in the world, if you're going to be in the music business. You have to be within an hour's drive of London, New York, or L.A. I just think that there's a lot of truth in that, and I think for you to have the stature that you have and to have not done it flash in a pan, not done it with your first album, then over in your second,
and not lived in one of those cities to do it.
That's my whole point. I really think that it's more remarkable than your either your modesty or your perspective allows you to see. I really do. Really do. And I mean,
well, it's not. I mean, I guess so. I mean, it certainly is hard. I mean, it's hard enough in Australia to get. To get by in the pubs without being sort of ending up with 20 stitches in your head. Let alone to the airport.
You learn some basic survival tactics, you know. Let me tell you, I mean, that's the truth. Everybody shame.
Mary, Mary, wanna be with you.
with a cover version of an Australian hit by the Easy Beats. That's INXS, plus Aussie favorite Jimmy Barnes singing Good Times from the Lost Boys movie soundtrack in 1987, and now included on the INXS anthology Shine Like It Does. I'm Redbeard, in the studio.